If you recognize that theme music, you're one of the millions of public television viewers hooked on Downton Abbey, the popular and highly addictive British drama series about a dazzling aristocratic family and the faithful and not so faithful servants below stairs who make all that grandeur possible. The Guinness Book of World Records calls Downton Abbey the most highly acclaimed TV show of all time. It won 6 Emmys last year, is nominated for 4 Golden Globes this year, and there are likely more awards to come. Today on All Sides, we're talking with Rebecca Eaton, the executive producer of PBS Masterpiece since 1985. She's responsible for bringing Downton Abbey and many other high-profile British series to American public television. Time magazine named her one of the most influential people of 2011. She has 34 Primetime Emmy Awards, 17 Peabody Awards, a Golden Globe, and 2 Academy Award nominations. Wow, Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you.
For our listeners, are you watching Downton Abbey? What attracts you to the stories and characters of this public television series? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Rebecca, when did you realize that Downton Abbey was going to be something really special for Masterpiece and public television audiences? Because you're the one that decides, right?
I'm the decider, yes, as somebody once famously said, for better or worse. And I wish I could say that I knew it the first time I heard about it at the first page of the script that I read before it was made. Unfortunately, that's not true, although, I mean, this is showbiz. Do I necessarily have to tell the truth? Yeah, it's public radio, I better. Okay, so I think none of us knew. We all knew it would be good, solid, masterpiece quality material. But I don't think either we or the producers in England, where it was shown first, Julian Fellowes included, knew it would be as big as it eventually got until it aired in England. And that was a few months last year. This is series one, last year before we aired it. And the audience went nuts. This obsession started, and that's what happens to people when they start watching it. They get obsessed.
I think since Pride and Prejudice, personally, I haven't seen such a beautifully produced everything. Yeah. Every little detail is incredibly authentic feeling.
Well, I would have to differ a little bit to say I think, I mean, if you watch Masterpiece Sunday night in and Sunday night out on PBS, we've been doing this for 40 years.
Right.
Most of the period productions, the classic productions, adaptations, have this kind of detail. It is the hallmark of British drama. Most of our productions come from the BBC. This one happens to come from ITV, which is commercial television in the UK. It is like NBC, CBS in the UK. And so I think, and more people are seeing it. So I think this shines a light on the quality of British television program making, because they are incredibly high-end. The costumes, I mean, starting with the scripts and the locations, but the costumes, the cinematography, the lighting, there is a certain quality to it which I think is unrivaled in television anywhere.
Of course, it helps that they actually have these castles and these incredible manor houses in, you know, they're actually, it's being shot on location at
House. I mean, we have arguably the landscape in this country when you think of the places you can shoot in this country, not necessarily the architecture. I mean, England is a small island, and they have loved and preserved their stately homes and their castles and their abbeys. We tend to tear them down and put in a parking lot, to quote somebody else famous. Mm-hmm. They tend to nationalize them. They make them part of the National Trust, which is an organization that buys these great, huge houses when the families can't afford to keep them up, just as the Crawley family is struggling with in Downton Abbey, being able to afford to have the cash to keep up Downton Abbey. Many, many British families haven't been able to, so they have sold them to the trust, which then open them to the public and don't tear them down. So the producers of Downton Abbey looked at hundreds of houses before they chose the one where this is shot. It's called Highclere Castle, and it's in Berkshire, and it is open to the public. You can go there, not when Downton Abbey is being filmed, but when off-season, you can go and walk through the rooms where the show is shot.
My guest is Rebecca Eaton. She's executive producer of PBS Masterpiece, and we're talking about Downton Abbey, the most popular show ever, period. I mean, it was on the New York Times, the front page of the New York Times.
It's on the front page of the New York Times. It was in the New York Times yesterday. We are truly in another orbit of popular culture. Masterpiece has been an icon for years, but now we have a whole new audience, I think, and a whole new kind of attention from media all over. We were on the NBC Nightly News the other night. The Nightly News with Brian Williams.
It's very big. By the way, I just want to tell our listeners that if you haven't caught Downton Abbey yet, it's on Sunday nights at 9 p.m. for the next 7 weeks on WOSU-TV, and you can go to our website at WOSU.org and learn more about it at your leisure.
You can also, I have to interrupt to say, people who don't know what we're talking about, who might have missed it, there are probably five people in your audience maybe who haven't heard of it. You can stream it. You can stream the first episode that aired last Sunday in Columbus. So it's actually on for 6 more weeks, but you can catch up by watching the first episode online.
The series was very popular, of course, in the UK, but that doesn't always mean American audiences will feel the same way. It was actually the first series, the first last season, was shortened by 35 minutes for American public television. Why was that done? There was a little bit of, you know, chit-chat about that out there.
Yeah, there was a little bit of bad press about that is what there was. And the story is very innocent and very straightforward. The way, as I said, this was aired on a commercial network in the UK. It had commercials, and therefore it was formatted differently. Public television has none. We run for a straight hour. So it had to be edited. The episodes had to be edited together to fit our time slots. This is a formatting issue we have always with all British shows. And over the course of, it was something like 8 or 9 hours last season. Last season was shorter than this season. We asked the producers to format it for our time slot. So they did the editing. We didn't take anything out. They nipped and tucked throughout the 8 or 9 hours to make it fit. A reporter in the UK got wind of this story and reported that we had taken 2 hours out of it and that we had done that to make it more intelligible to an American audience. In other words, that we had to kind of dumb it down, which was so wrong. But of course, you know, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. So that story started circulating around and people were concerned. But they took the time out and it was probably, let's see, a lot of comings and goings in cars and nipping and tucking around scenes. We didn't eliminate any characters or any storylines.
I know Laura Linney, in her initial introduction of the series, brings up the issue of what an entailment is. And I wondered, is that was something. I mean, I'm, you know, if you're a big Jane Austen fan, everybody knows what an entailment is.
But sort of. It's actually called an entail.
Entail,
and
right,
there's a lot of talk about the entail.
I don't even know how to say it, right.
And when I read the scripts and then when I saw it, I said, you know, I don't understand this. What I know it's roughly the cash, the money that, for instance, Lady Cora, played by Elizabeth McGovern, the American heiress, brings to the table when she marries Lord Grantham. And an entail is the amount of money it necessary to the upkeep of the house of Downton Abbey. It costs a fortune to run, if you picture it. Not that the servants are paid so much, but there is grounds and fields and orchards, not to mention the crumbling house. So the entail, I thought that's what it was. So I was speaking to the producers and saying, I'm not sure it's certainly not a familiar concept to American audiences. And they said, well, it's not familiar to the British either. And they couldn't explain it very well succinctly. I'm sure Julian Fellowes could, right down to the ground. But it is a very arcane British thing having to do with the upkeep of houses, and it did cause some head scratching.
Julian Fellowes has said that what makes the series popular is that we treat all the characters the same. We don't suggest that the upstairs people are more important than the downstairs people, and that feels so true. It's just as gripping either way.
Yes, and it is obviously this is not a new concept in that, 40 years ago, upstairs, downstairs did the same thing. Mm-hmm. We knew the people downstairs. We knew Hudson and Mrs. Bridges and Rose from the original Upstairs, Downstairs, as well as we knew the people upstairs, the family upstairs. But I think Julian Fellowes, the writer, the creator of Downton Abbey, has gone even further by really spending equal time with the downstairs and going deeper into their personal lives, their backgrounds, their dramas. And there is more genuine relationship, I would say. I think I'm a little bit on thin ice here, but I would venture there's more a genuine relationship between the downstairs and the upstairs. For instance, Anna downstairs and Lady Mary, the eldest daughter of the Crawley family, are very, very close. I think they are closer than Lady Mary is to her sisters, Edith and Sybil. And even though it's not a friendship per se, I mean, they don't socialize, they share their deepest feelings and secrets with each other. Certainly Anna knows Lady Mary's terrible secret from Series 1, which I won't reveal for those people who haven't seen it, and they protect each other, which I think is, here's what I think is the real key to the success of Downton. This is my own personal theory, is that for us, these modern days, community is an elusive thing. To have a real group, be surrounded by a group of people besides your own family who have your back and who care about you and with whom you have to live make a good life. And I think that's what Downton Abbey is. It is an enclosed protective community. And I think people are really drawn to that, not to of course forget the gorgeous dresses and the setting and all the dinner parties.
Well, I think that what the character development is amazing. And my very first impression of Lady Mary is yuck. And yet it changes and it goes back and forth, and it does it with all the characters. It's not just these main characters. Let's listen to a cut. In this scene from the first season of Downton Abbey, the oldest daughter, Lady Mary Crawley, asks her father, Robert Crawley, Earl of Grantham, why he won't do more to help her inherit the estate.
If I could take Mama's money out of the estate, Downton would have to be sold to pay for it. Is that what you want? To see Matthew a landless peer with a title but no means to pay for it?
So I'm just to find a husband and get out of the way?
You could stay here if you married Matthew.
You know my character, Father. I'd never marry any man that I was told to. I'm stubborn. I wish I wasn't, but I am.
That's the point where you kind of sort of like her.
Yeah.
Because she's a horrible snob, but she's also the oldest daughter and in a different position than the other two.
Well, yes, very much. I think she's very much an oldest daughter, an oldest sister. And I love how they portray the sisterly rivalries and sniping and affections. So they grow up. And I think, Series 1 was set in 1912, and it starts on the day the Titanic goes down, which, by the way, is 100 years ago this year, 2012. And Series 2 begins in 1916, and World War I has begun, and Matthew Crawley is in France in the trenches, and there are big changes happening back at Downton Abbey. And so Mary is 4 years older, But I think Julian Fellowes, the creator of all these characters, has seen from how the actors portray the parts, I think that he has understood where he can take the characters. This is what happens in the second series. It's a combination of what's in the fertile imagination of the writer, then being fed by the excellent work of actors. And this cast, I mean, yes, there's Maggie Smith, and you just start laughing.
Of course, yeah.
As soon as the camera comes to her, before she says anything, because somehow Julian has completely channeled who that kind of woman would be and given her the lines, and Maggie just takes them and runs with them. But all of the actors, some of them I would say we've never seen before in American television, have such subtlety and intelligence and depth of feeling in their characters that I think Julian thought, oh, well, then this could happen to that character because I know this actor can handle it.
My guest is Rebecca Eaton, executive producer of PBS Masterpiece. We're talking about the hit British drama on PBS, Downton Abbey. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and the WOSU member card benefit of the month for January is Pro Musica Chamber Orchestra. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission to Happy Year of the Dragon, January 21st and 22nd. Become a basic $60 member and get your member card by going to WOSU.org right now.
Support for the Statehouse News Bureau stories on 89.7 come from the Ohio Education Association, representing 131,000 teachers, support professionals, and higher educational faculty who are working for great public schools for every child. Online at ohea.org.
Light rain showers in the forecast for today and a high of 46 degrees. A rain-snow mix this evening and then some snow overnight. Little to no accumulation, but colder, a low of 23 degrees. Expect some light snow for Friday and a high of just 26. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. My guest is Rebecca Eaton. She's executive producer of PBS Masterpiece, and we're talking right now about Downton Abbey, the hit series on PBS, brought to us from England. If you have a question or comment for Rebecca, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. The characters, I mean, the sisters, you brought up the sisters, Rebecca, and the three daughters, as I was, you know, reviewing the arc last night, they just appear to represent three really distinct phases or examples of women mm-hmm. in the process of self-actualization, self-realization.
Mm-hmm.
Lady Mary is caught, kind of trapped by the past and the past traditions. The middle daughter is got to fend for herself. She doesn't have the status of oldest daughter, but she's not very attractive, although, I don't know, she has her moments. And she's got to really get out there and scrap. And the younger one is from a completely different generation almost.
Yes. Interesting. I actually haven't done the math to figure the age difference, mm-hmm. what's supposed to be the age difference between them. And I think it's true. Lady Mary, the eldest sister, was brought up to be the lady of Downton, and she had been, when this first episode of the first series begins, engaged to marry the heir, who was a remote cousin, and you know that had been sort of arranged. I don't think she was desperately in love with him, but that was her life, and she'd been brought up to be her mother. And then all of a sudden he dies when the Titanic goes down, which means they have to find another heir. It can't be her, because in those days it couldn't be a daughter. It had to be a male heir. And she has to marry. That is how she has been schooled, trained, and brought up. And yet, she's a passionate, sensitive, intelligent woman, and she just can't marry anyone. So then her life begins to get very complicated. The middle sister, I love this actress, Laura. She isn't like the sister at all, and has to play the plain Jane, which is a tough part to do. But she's the one who's in Mary's shadow and tries very hard to sort of find her own way. First, she subverts Mary, and as you know from series one, she tries to ruin Mary's life. But she has a little bit of growing up, and kind of gets out of that stage. But she's the one who needs a date. And we laugh about that when we were together on the set. If we just have to find her a boyfriend, and she said, "I know." And I keep trying, and various unlikely people show up. There are two very unlikely people in series two. So everybody's got their fingers crossed for Lady Edith. And then Sybil is the rebel. Sybil's the one who gets political and begins to have a relationship with Gasp, the chauffeur.
At first blush, she seems the least likely to do that because her persona seems milder and more recessive,
yes.
But it's anything
well,
but.
Well, she's young.
Yeah.
She's young. She's the youngest sister. And then, as I say, you see her 4 years later. She grows up and begins to look around, and the world is changing. That becomes, even though it's very frowned upon, the possibility of having a relationship with the chauffeur appears to her as a possibility for a life. And that's one of the storylines in series two is, can she do this? Will her family disown her? Will she have to break with the Crawley family forever? Is this man a good man? This is Julian sort of riding the times, the political and social times of England in that period.
Kathy in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. You enjoy the historical backdrop.
Yes, I do very much. I'm surprised that up until I went to visit my sister a couple weeks ago, and she said, "Have you ever seen this show?" And I said, "No, I never heard of it." So she Netflixed it, and we watched all seven episodes.
Yeah.
And I stayed up one night, and they went to bed, my sister and brother-in-law, and I watched probably four or five episodes back to back. And
it's dangerous.
I couldn't stop. But I love history, but I really love the, you know, was it Carson, you know, trying to answer the telephone and figure out
the butler,
how to do that. And then the automobiles, and Edith wants to drive the automobile, and Sybil with her woman's suffrage, you know, that was. And then in this last episode, this past Sunday, they said so many times the world is changing.
Yeah.
And I love knowing that whenever a show like this comes on, there has to be so much background check to make sure that things are factual.
It is what you say is one of its strengths. I think it is social history. And if somebody said, "Watch public television tonight at 9 for social history," you might say, "Oh no," you know. But it is a fabulously told story. You know, four or five dramatic storylines of people's personal lives, but the detail of how they're telling the story weaves in all this information about what life was really like then. And you can read it in a book, but it's different to just see it happening in a scene about something else, or seeing people being afraid of electricity, afraid that it was dangerous to have in the house. It would come out of the wall and hurt you. You know, the outlets emit something. They used to be afraid that there was something coming out of the outlets for electricity, so they would cover them up or try to avoid them. And that kind of thing, you know, I think it's a generation of people today have no idea how all this stuff started, whether it's automobiles or electricity or women's rights, even.
I thought it was interesting, and Kathy, thanks again for your call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
I thought it was interesting, the point that was made, when they were standing around the telephone, I think it was that, and they're all kind of standing there waiting for it to ring, but they don't know how to use it. It was very cute. But someone made the point, he goes, "Why are they so interested in this?" And someone said, "Well, the young are always interested in change."
Yeah.
They're not afraid of it. It's a lot like today with the computers and the internet and the everything.
Yes, I mean, it is all about change. And we're riding a very fast train here because hopefully Downton will go on to Series 3 and, you know, on and on and on. But so much starts to change in the world. The world, British, let's just not speak of the whole world, but just England. Up until 1912, when Downton starts, things had stayed the same. There was a monarchy. There was a working class. That's how things. There was no middle class. Year in, year out, generation in and out. But all of a sudden, certainly with World War One, it started to change fast and picks up speed in every decade. So you can imagine Downton 3 being set in the 20s. Which, you know, time will pass and we will be in the 20s. Think of the changes that happen. It's a speeding train, and Julian is working to weave the characters into that.
Joanna in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Joanna.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to say, I think echoing what we're talking about now, the subtlety with which the change is being conveyed is what's exquisite on the show. I mean, the hemlines are moving up an inch at a time. The corsetry is subtly disappearing under Lady Cora's top and Lady Mary, and the silhouettes are relaxing just as the rules are relaxing. Mm-hmm. And I think that intricate issue of the visual relaxing, you know, where Carson's saying this is how things are done, and he's absolutely going apoplectic because things are shattering.
Yep.
But yet the fashions and the attitudes are just moving through what's really happening socially, and I think it's exquisite. And I have been a lifetime Masterpiece Theater person, going all the way back to Brideshead Revisited and savoring Poirot and Art Deco, and just how exquisite the all of these things are. Oh, my God.
Thank you.
I mean, I own every episode of most of these on DVR because they're going to be my retirement, actually, just sitting there watching them over and over.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I feel the same way. I have to say, if I didn't have this job, I would be just like you. It's completely my cup of tea. There is one thing about the hemlines, which is interesting that you noticed that. The costume designer, Susanna Buxton, won an Emmy for the costume design, as she well should have. These are all original clothes. In other words, she scoured thrift shops, costumers. A lot of these were made for ladies in that time. Sometimes she would find just a piece of fabric, and then she would redesign a dress around it. But as she says, the period of style in Edwardian times was really brief. In other words, ladies had been wearing gowns right down to the ground, covering everything, until the period just around when we start. And if you think about what flappers were wearing just 10 years later, less than 10 years in some cases, the hemline stayed at just showing an ankle for a very short time. It was sort of like, here's a little glimpse, and all of a sudden, whoosh, the hemlines went way up and representing a gigantic change. But I love that it's the hemlines even tell a story, that here's a glimpse. It's a little glimpse of the future. And you're right to say that every detail of the costumes, the hair, the jewelry, indicates that things are relaxing. Not too much, but just a little.
And you really, just by watching it, feel the weight of the beads on those dresses. They're not fake. It looks like they've got as many beads on as they do, and it feels it and sounds it. Joanna, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye.
Ellen in Columbus. Welcome to the show, Ellen.
My question is, there was also this past season a new version of Upstairs, Downstairs. Due to the success of Downton Abbey, is that going to be dropped?
No. In fact, I mean, it was a very loaded season because these two programs, which had many similarities and people were comparing them, and it's a very tricky competition. Comparisons are odious. Upstairs, Downstairs, the new Upstairs, Downstairs, which was only three episodes. Downton was, I think we ran it in four long episodes. over 4 weeks, but it was many hours longer because we had some long episodes. The thing about Upstairs Downstairs is that it had to compete against Downton and itself. It had to compete about the old, compete against the old Upstairs Downstairs. So people were sharpening the knives even before the first scene. And it had some bugs to work out. It has been recommissioned, and they've just finished shooting 6 new episodes.
Is that a BBC?
Yes.
Okay.
That's BBC. It used to be commercial television back in the day, 40 years ago. The old Upstairs Downstairs was commercial television. This is BBC, and it will air a year from now, or a year from this spring, on Masterpiece. 6 new hours, and some characters are coming back. Some are not. There's some new ones. And I think it's finding its feet. And Downton is a big big competitor, but I think Upstairs Downstairs develops its own tone.
Thank you, Ellen, for that. Let's listen to one more cut in this scene from last Sunday's first episode of season 2 of Downton Abbey. Lady Mary goes to the train station to say goodbye to her cousin Matthew Crowley as he is about to return to the trenches of World War I.
Mary, if I don't come back, no, if I don't, then do remember how very glad I am that we made up. Will you look after Mother if anything happens?
Of course we will, but it won't.
And Lavinia. She's young and she'll find someone else. I hope she does anyway.
Goodbye, then. And such good luck.
Goodbye, Mary. And God bless you.
This is romantic drama on the grand scale. Characters separated by war and differing social status to that. Beautiful Lady Mary began the series last season as a cold fish, as I mentioned. But now she's become quite vulnerable and fallen in love with Matthew, who's, I think, her third cousin, actually. He's engaged to another woman at that point. Lots of drama.
Yes, lots of drama. I love these two actors. We've gotten to know them very well because they've come over to do publicity, and they are the just sweetest, funniest, most wonderful. And that scene, they play so perfectly because you know that they care so much for each other. You want them to be in love. You want them to be together. But Matthew is engaged to Lavinia, and Mary has another gentleman caller. And that, I think, is the little engine at the heart of Downton Abbey, is the relationship between these two people. And my theory is, for most successful masterpieces that we've done over the years, you need that. You need a relationship that you completely believe in and want to happen. And other storylines go through, but you just, please, Matthew, please, Mary, recognize what we all see.
Get together.
You're in love with each other. You'll have to see if it works.
From Beth on Facebook, she said, just started watching the show this week. I've watched the first 3 episodes of season 1 and plan to be caught up by the end of the weekend. I absolutely love this show. From Richard on Facebook, my wife and I visited Highclere Castle some years ago and we're excited to see it in this series. I think what attracts me is the range of characters, personalities, and issues that are included.
Mm-hmm.
And an email from Jeff. He says, if I miss an episode, I'd like to be able to see it later. I don't have a DVR. Will past episodes of this season's broadcast be available on demand? VSA Netflix or my cable company or the internet? And that's yes to the internet. I know that.
And yes to Netflix.
Okay.
He'd have to go fast to be able to see them on the PBS website, but definitely Netflix. You can always buy it. You know, that would be a good idea.
Go to the PBS.
Public television. And episode 2 is this Sunday. Is a little tricky because the other thing that's happening this Sunday is the Golden Globes. And as you said, Downton is nominated for 4 Golden Globes. Maggie Smith, Elizabeth McGovern as Cora, Hugh Bonneville as Robert, the Earl of Grantham, and the series is nominated for Best Miniseries. So we need everybody to DVR one or the other of them, but definitely you have to watch Downton this Sunday.
Downton Abbey, the most popular television series of all time.
Yeah, okay. I'll take that.
Right. Rebecca Eaton, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Anne. It's been fun.
Rebecca Eaton, she's executive producer of PBS Masterpiece. We've been talking about Downton Abbey on PBS. You can watch it Sunday night at 9 p.m. on WOSU-TV. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I do so long to go through the crowded streets of your mighty London.
Actor Gary Oldman is so good at what he does, you might not recognize him from role to role. From his campy portrayal of Dracula, to Sirius Black in Harry Potter, and now George Smiley in Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. Gary Oldman on the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And join us tomorrow for All Sides Weekend with host Christopher Purdy and a discussion of Catco's latest production, The Rubenstein Kiss. Join us for All Sides Weekend tomorrow morning from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
And you can help shorten the 89.7 NPR News winter membership drive. Become a sustaining member right now. For every 100 sustaining members we receive, we will eliminate one day from our drive. Just visit WOSU.org and make your sustaining gift right now. And thanks for your support. Light rain today and then a rain-snow mix for tonight, a low of 23 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
You to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
That's the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. speaking on April 3, 1968, the day before he was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. Now, a book that goes well beyond that iconic segment to examine how that final speech reflects the civil rights leader's interpretation of the Bible and his commitment to nonviolent protest and social justice. The author of the book is Arizona State University professor Keith Miller, a leading expert on the speeches and oratory of Martin Luther King Jr. His latest book is Martin Luther King's Biblical Epic, His Final Great Speech. Welcome to the show, Professor Miller.
Thank you, Ann. Thank you for asking me to be here.
Monday, January 16th is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. To our listeners, it's celebrated in Central Ohio as a day of service. We'll post a link on our website to the City of Columbus events, and we'd ask you to let us know, listeners, how are you planning to celebrate the legacy of Martin Luther King? Post that on our website. You can also go to our All Sides with Ann Fisher's Facebook page and post it there as well. And you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Professor Miller, in his final speech, I've Been to the Mountaintop, it was an hour-long speech, which explains why, immediately afterward, King almost fell into a chair situated behind the podium. But most folks only remember the final 2 minutes, those that we just heard, where King seems to foreshadow his own short life. What else in that speech is particularly memorable to you, the scholar who has studied it?
Well, I think the whole speech is memorable. It's extremely eloquent. Some people think it's his greatest speech. His best friend, Ralph Abernathy, who was there, thinks it was his best speech. To me, the ending, people misunderstand the speech because there's so much attention to the ending that people have not paid attention to the rest of the speech. But the ending concludes something. It's a conclusion. If he only wanted to talk for 2 minutes, he would have talked for 2 minutes. So to really understand the ending, you need to understand the whole speech, look at the whole speech, but also that helps understand the ending.
Well, he certainly could speak in sound bites, though, right? Like all great orators, Martin Luther King Jr. had a way of making his words come across as extemporaneous, you know, of the moment. And to what extent did he follow a script and or pull from the moment, you know, at the moment from his education at, you know, Boston University, where he graduated with a doctorate in theology? How much was it written down and how much was it ad-libbed?
Well, when he started his career, he would have a text that he would be reading from. But, you know, when he gets about halfway through his career, roughly something like that, his career lasted 12 years, he stopped doing that. He had enough material that he had memorized, and he could play around with the memorized material and put in some new comment. I actually think that his African-American roots are way more important to him than in his speaking than his education at Boston University. I think a lot of people have overplayed that.
I think this is the second book that I've interviewed somebody about that actually is dissecting a speech of his. In yours, you write about the interconnectedness of King and Gandhi and how Gandhi's influence on him wasn't from his own readings, but from the people around him. And so when he's talking about nonviolence, for instance, it's coming via his mentors and leaders in the African-American community.
Yes, his most important mentor was his father. After that was Benjamin Mays. Benjamin Mays was the president of Morehouse College, and King became close to him when he was an undergraduate. He used to listen to Benjamin Mays once a week at the chapel at Morehouse. He would go to Benjamin Mays' office and talk about the chapel talks. And Mays had gotten a Ph.D. from University of Chicago, so Mays set an example to King to go get a Ph.D. in the North. And Mays and his friend Howard Thurman had both gone to India in the 1930s to talk to Gandhi. At that time, they were at Howard University in Washington, D.C., but they personally went to India to talk to Gandhi, and they talked to Gandhi about using black people using nonviolence in the United States to overthrow segregation. So, and there were other African Americans who were interested in Gandhi as well, and big African American newspapers like the Pittsburgh Courier, Chicago Defender, they followed Gandhi and they reported on Gandhi in the 1930s and 1940s. So there was a lot of interest in Gandhi in the African American community in the generation before King.
My guest is Keith Miller. He's an English professor at Arizona State University. He's also author of Martin Luther King's Biblical Epic, His Final Great Speech. If you have a question or comment for Professor Miller, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post there if you'd like. You've also written the book Voice of Deliverance, The Language of Martin Luther King Jr. and Its Sources. What sets apart, you've already said you think it's his greatest speech, but in terms of what you do as a scholar, what sets apart King's final speech enough to warrant an entire book on it?
Well, people have written whole books about the Gettysburg Address, which lasted 3 minutes, so that led me to think
okay.
I could write a speech about a book that lasted an hour. One thing that happened that night is he's speaking at Mason Temple in Memphis, Tennessee. It's the largest venue available to African Americans in the whole South. And even though there was a giant thunderstorm that night, 3,000 people showed up. The architect, I have a chapter of the book that deals with the architecture of the Mason Temple. The architect is an extremely obscure African American. We don't even know his first name. His last name is Taylor. Somehow this architect was ingenious enough that he could design the sanctuary so that he creates 3,700 seats, but somehow they're all pretty close to the pulpit. He manages to do this and gets the pulpit pretty close to everybody. So the 3,000 supporters were very enthusiastic because they came to hear King despite the rainstorm, and they were sitting close to him, so they cheered him on, and they pushed him to greater eloquence because he's using the call-and-response delivery of the African-American preachers.
Since the civil rights movement that King led before, you know, his death and has inspired since, has anything around the world compared, in your opinion?
I think that there's great potential for nonviolence that people haven't fully understood yet. Part of the reason is that there's a lot we need to understand about mass movements. It's more than one. It's been simply one leader. There are lots of people who are leaders in the civil rights movement, including women who have been overshadowed by King, mm-hmm. but who made gigantic contributions, people like Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer, Gloria Richardson. There's lots of them. of dynamics in mass movements that we still need to understand so we can get nonviolence to work in other situations. The Arab Spring is certainly very promising, especially what happened in Tunisia and Egypt, where you have people who don't have a Gandhi or Martin Luther King, at least it's not that apparent to us, and somehow they managed to do mass movements to overthrow dictatorships without violence, basically without violence on the part of the protesters.
What did you learn from your analysis of the speech for this book, to write this book? Obviously, you went into it, you're already an expert, but you also had to be curious, and that's what drove you. So what came of it for you personally?
Well, one thing, in the speech, King talks about the Exodus, and African Americans during slavery talked about the Exodus, and they longed for an Exodus. Some of them saw Abraham Lincoln as a Moses or Harriet Tubman as a Moses. And King plots this Memphis strike as a moment in the Exodus. He basically calls the mayor a Pharaoh. And he views the Bible as a kind of an ongoing drama. The Bible, to him, is incidentally a book. It's incidentally this piece of parchment written a long time ago. But it's basically a drama and a narrative that keeps going on. So he's interpreting African-American struggle as the struggle that takes place within an Exodus narrative. And he got that from African-American culture because what he was taught about the Exodus in seminary and in his PhD program was pretty much the opposite.
How so?
Well, his seminary professors were noted Old Testament scholars, but they looked at the Bible very historically and scientifically, and they tried to strip away the folklore and the mythology from the Bible, and they thought that they told him that Moses did not even exist. So they tried to figure out what was actually happening with the history of the Israelites and what was made up. But King interprets the Bible very differently because to him, the Bible is still going on. There's still a narrative. The biblical categories and biblical stories are still are continuing. And the mayor in Phoenix is the mayor in Memphis is a pharaoh.
You in your book, you make the point that King is arguing that one can grasp Jesus only by first grasping Moses and the Hebrew prophets. And that's a big departure, of the usual interpretations?
Exactly. The usual interpretation that Christianity has had is that it supplants and replaces Judaism. King's argument is that the social gospel of the Exodus narrative that's continued with the Hebrew prophets, because Moses and the Hebrew prophets, are all who he quotes in the speech, are all concerned about the entire Hebrew people. All the Hebrew people, including the poor, the needy, the orphans, the widows. And King sees Jesus as a kind of an extension and culmination of that. So he's affirming Judaism as the basis of Christianity, as the wellspring of Christianity. And he makes these connections between Christianity and Judaism all the time in that speech and also in I Have a Dream.
You mentioned the mostly unknown African-American architect who created the church sanctuary where he spoke that night and the connection that it gave him with his audience. How typical was that kind of physical relationship in his speeches in terms of how it affected the speech itself? For instance, I Have a Dream was a very different situation.
Right. The call and response dynamic where you have this electricity going back and forth between the speaker and the audience because the audience is doing callbacks, amen, hallelujah, preach on, like
and
that.
And you can hear that in the recordings.
You can hear that in recordings. That's very important to King because there's a lot of material. If you read lots of his speeches and sermons, there's a lot of material that he repeats. I think what happens is when the audience responds enthusiastically, that's a part of the speech that he tends to reuse in the next speech. And if something falls flat, then he doesn't reuse that. So I think the audience response, in a way, is part of his composing process. And I Have a Dream, and in I've Been to the Mountaintop, there's lots of parts of the speeches that he had used before.
It's interesting when I listen to the speech and when I've listened to other of his speeches, watching that, there's some really great video of that speech where it's coming from behind the podium, so you see everything that's going on. And I mentioned early on in the interview that at first, he seems completely undone by this. He immediately almost falls into a chair, and people are sort of supporting him physically, but his intonation and everything that he did during the speech, you never sense that at all. The energy that he's able to put forth is amazing. And I was just wondering, did you look at that at all?
It is amazing, especially because he was exhausted that right. night, and he didn't even want to give the speech. And he asked Abernathy to speak in his favor instead of him. So when Abernathy gets there, he sees 3,000 people, and they're all enthusiastic. And he calls King, and he says, Martin, I want you to speak. We need you to come here. So King says, well, okay, if you said so, Ralph, I'll show up. So King was inspired because there were 3,000 people, and if the rally had been scheduled any other place in Memphis, there wouldn't have been nearly that many people because there was no other venue that could hold anything like that many people. So he wouldn't even have given the speech at all. It's only because this African-American Pentecostal denomination could raise the funds to create this sanctuary, which was their national headquarters, that he was even able to give the speech at all. So, yes, he was exhausted. He was exhausted at the end, yeah.
We often talk about how he foreshadowed his own death. It's a very famous line in it. And yet I wonder, was he really? I mean, was it directly related to a fear of assassination at that point?
Well, what's interesting, I don't think he actually knew he was going to be killed the next day.
Right, of course.
The reason I think that is because if you go back to Montgomery bus boycott, fairly often he talks about death threats, mm-hmm. and he talks about he knows people are trying to kill him or may kill him, and he expects to be killed. He talks about that publicly pretty often. I don't think that he knew he was going to be killed the next day. And the audience didn't either, because everybody is cheering, and there's joy that floods the sanctuary, especially at the end of the speech. Everybody is ecstatic. So what I try to do is look at the speech on the night that he gave it. What was it like? And I try to get my readers to think about what it would be like to be in there in that sanctuary listening to the speech on the night that he gave it.
Keith Miller, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Ann. It's my pleasure.
Keith Miller, he is the author of a new book. It's called Martin Luther King's Biblical Epic, His Final Great Speech. He's an English professor at Arizona State University. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.